All right, that's been our show. Thanks again for listening, and thank you again, caller. I'm sorry I forgot to get your name for that great request from Half Japanese. Great band.
Thank you, caller, and thank you, listeners. Feel free to call or text next time. We'll be back next week, same time.
All right. Until then, good night.
Good night.
The station you're listening to is powered by AzuraCast, the free and open source software that makes web radio simple. If you're hearing this message, your station's ready to go. Just add new music to your playlists. If you need help or to learn more about AzuraCast, visit azuracast.com.
This has been a rebroadcast of our August 12th program.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Today, we have a special episode with Professor David Shumway of the Literature Department at Carnegie Mellon University. He studies film. Thanks for coming on the show, Professor.
My pleasure.
Yeah, so you could tell us a little bit about yourself to get us started.
Well, I've been writing and studying about film since my days in graduate school at Indiana University in the 1970s. I've taught film at Carnegie Mellon since the mid-80s. I was involved in starting the film minor here and then in starting the film major. I've written about film in a number of different contexts, published in Cinema Journal. I have a book about the film director John Sayles. I have books about romance, where I write about romantic comedies and romance films like Casablanca and Gone with the Wind. So I have broad interest in cinema, especially American, but...
So what attracted you to studying cinema in the first place?
Well, when I was in high school, I was interested in the arts, especially in novels, which I regarded as a significant art form, but kind of realized at that point that it seemed as though the most interesting artists working at that moment were not novelists, but filmmakers. That was on the heels of the French New Wave and other important European directors who had really made a big splash here, and the beginning of the American auteur movement with people like Martin Scorsese and others making their first movies.
When would you say that change happened, when sort of the chief artists of a generation became the filmmakers?
Sometime in the 60s. I mean, there were great artists earlier, but they weren't generally recognized as such.
Mm-hmm. So I'll ask you a question you probably get a lot. What's your favorite movie to come out in 2024 so far?
Oh, in 2024?
Or any recent movie.
So what? Maybe my favorite movie in 2024 is Between the Temples, an independent film about a young cantor who is trying to figure out both his wife has recently died, so it's about his emotional difficulties, but also, of course, his relationship with the temple where he sings. It's the kind of movie that I like. It's small. It's about humans and their problems, and it's also funny. So, but you can tell that the title's a pun, Between the Temples being the brain, but also the place where he works.
Yeah, so I guess I'll put that on my Letterboxd watched list. Do you have a Letterboxd?
I don't.
Okay, you've heard of it then?
Yes.
Yeah. So I recently got one, and that has become my sort of chief place to get movie recommendations. Where would you recommend regular people find good movies to watch, especially ones that might not be getting a lot of TV coverage on commercials, maybe smaller independent movies? Where do you find these?
Well, the New York Times reviews virtually every movie that gets a commercial release in the United States. So that's a good source. Richard Brody of The New Yorker is a really interesting critic. I don't always agree with him. His views are very idiosyncratic, but he will point you in the direction of movies that you might not have paid attention to.
I'm curious about that interaction between film critique and film. Obviously, film affects film critique. Film critics are writing about movies, but has there ever really been some significant trends the other way? Have the work of film critics ever affected the way that people make movies?
Well, yes. In particularly some act very explicitly direct ways, the people who made the films that we make up the French New Wave, almost to the last one of them, began their careers as film critics for a journal in Paris called the Cahiers du Cinéma, which was edited by André Bazin, who is sometimes called the father of serious film criticism. And he nurtured these people, who then went on to find ways to raise small amounts of money and make films that changed the way we think about cinema, like Godard's Breathless and Truffaut's The 400 Blows. In the United States, Paul Schrader wrote an essay published in 1970 in a small magazine called Notes on Film Noir. Schrader, of course, goes on to write the screenplay for Taxi Driver and then to become a very estimable director himself. But it's interesting that Notes on Film Noir occurs 2 years before Chinatown appears and the beginning of the neo-noir revival. So almost certainly Schrader's essay influenced that trend in filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that one of your particular interests is American cinema. What are some of the ways in that American cinema differs from other countries today? What are some things that we might not see out of Hollywood movies that other countries are doing?
Well, American cinema differs today from every other cinema. There is no other cinema in the world that is so focused on superhero movies, on franchises, on sequels, there's no other industry in the world that can support the budgets that Hollywood lavishes on those big production films. So we are an outlier. We're also still the dominant film industry in the world, though China is hot on our heels. But China does not produce anywhere near as many movies as we do, even to this day. They could if they wanted to. They have the largest film audience in the world, but they choose not to. Every other film, national film industry, remains, by American standards, sort of producing movies that look more like films did 30 or 40 years ago, which to me is all to the good. I much prefer those movies.
So on the topic of foreign films, they're getting popular. So Parasite recently won the first Oscar for Best Picture for a foreign movie. And you see a lot of people, especially younger people, consuming more anime and K-dramas from East Asia. There seems to be a trend in the United States to be able to consume more foreign media. What do you think has driven this trend, and do you see it having an impact on our domestic film industry?
Well, I think what's driven the trend is that people are hungry for different kinds of stories that these foreign films reflect. And I think films from Asia in particular are different enough from both European and American cinema that they really feel fresh to folks. We should keep in mind, though, that the audiences for these films, while significant in the sense that they bring in enough money given the scale that these films are produced at, to be significant, they're still, it's a tiny fraction of the larger film audience here. I mean, most Americans are not seeing those films. It's a niche audience.
Mm-hmm. Pivoting towards something that we talked about in the class that I took from you, Intro to Film Studies, we discussed the auteur filmmaker quite a bit. How does one person guiding the vision of an entire film change the way that it's made versus having multiple people act as director, cinematographer, screenwriter?
Well, I'm not sure it likely changes the way it is made. All films, I'm sure there's the odd exception that proves the rule, but basically all films are highly collaborative projects. There are hundreds of people working even on a very small budget movie these days. So the person who's the guiding intelligence is going to be having to use that collaborative system. The difference between films that have a clear auteur and those that don't mainly have to do with the relationship of a particular film to others that an individual has made. Howard Hawks, one of the great directors from the classic era of Hollywood cinema, who managed, unlike most of his contemporaries, to never have a long-term studio contract. So he could float among studios and have more control over his own work, asserted that a great film was a film that had a few good scenes and you could tell who the devil made it. And so what he meant by that was, if you could recognize a personal signature in the movie, that really mattered to him. It was part of what made the film valuable. And that's the basic idea behind the auteur theory, that you should be able to tell that this particular intelligence is behind the movie.
When you think of great filmmakers, great auteur filmmakers, a lot of times the names that come to mind are older people, whether in the golden age of Hollywood or filmmakers who are kind of nearing the end of their career. Who are some of the younger filmmakers to look out for right now?
Wes Anderson, I would say, is the most interesting auteur working in Hollywood today. Which isn't to say I like all of his movies, but I think every one of his movies is interesting, and I can always tell who the devil made it.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Wes Anderson movies myself. Grand Budapest Hotel is one of my favorites.
Also one of mine.
Sort of shifting over to your job, how do you teach students about film? I took your course a lot and remember enjoying it quite a bit, but it forced me to change the way that I watch movies. Watching a movie in a more analytical sense and being able to critique particular aspects definitely requires a sort of mindset change when you're watching a movie. What are some ways that you encourage students to approach that viewing experience with an eye for analysis and critique?
Well, by asking them to think about the way the film is made and structured, how it's edited. Are there long takes or lots of short ones? Is the dialogue intended to be realistic, or is it meant to be entertaining? Those two things are often opposed to each other. Are the settings evocative of an actual place, or are they more designed to evoke a kind of ideal world? I mean, there are so many levels in which you can analyze a film, which is why I think they are so fascinating to study. But by the way, I don't think people necessarily ought to go to the movies when they watch a film the first time and be primarily there to analyze it. I think it is important to let the film wash over you and to experience it as a piece of entertainment and as an emotional experience. Films are designed to evoke emotions in us. And so that's why watching movies more than once is really essential to be able to understand how they work. Because the second time you can begin to pay less attention to your emotions and think about the film more.
So a lot of times when we're talking about historical movies, we talk about the social or political context around them. However, when we talk about maybe more modern movies, it's sometimes a little harder to isolate that out because we're living in that social and political context. What are some of the social trends or political trends that you see affecting movies the most now, such that film critics in 50 years will look back and say, oh, they did this because of this trend?
Well, so clearly, the changing gender roles and attitudes towards sexuality are a major change. In classic Hollywood, basically, you have the heterosexual couple and the presumption that that couple will get married if the movie is to have a happy ending. And then there's a whole series of changes. I mean, in the late 60s and early 70s, you begin to get movies where people have relationships and they don't get married and it's not a tragedy. And part of this has to do with women beginning to be understood as not just being defined by their roles as wife and mother, but starting to have jobs outside the home that are more than just menial. And the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s and legal challenges to it in the early 70s are part of that context. But then, of course, attitudes towards homosexuality begin to change. Actually, they begin to change right around that same moment, but it's only been much more recently. It's been about 10 years, for example, since the Supreme Court ruled that same-sex marriage had to be legal across the country. That was a really significant event, and of course it has resulted in there being, say, romantic comedies about same-sex couples, which, I mean, there were a few before that, but not all that many. And of course we don't know, given the changes in the Supreme Court, whether same-sex marriage will continue to be legal. Many people fear that the current conservative court might overturn that ruling. But films, I think, will continue to reflect those changing attitudes. And presumably, we're going to see more gender diversity, more diversity of sexuality in movies as time goes on. One wonders how much the current political divisions in the country, which are about as bleak or as stark, stark is the better word, as they've ever been since the Civil War, whether that will be understood as a context for contemporary cinema. You see some of it reflected in a movie like Oppenheimer, which is partly about the kind of historical precursor moment, the McCarthy era, which affects the way in which Oppenheimer was treated, even though he was a national hero. Those are the two kind of recent political situations that come to mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. So for those of us in the audience and myself who have a pipe dream of becoming a filmmaker at some point in their life, how do people become filmmakers? We see the product, but a lot of times the business behind making movies is obscured. How does someone go from just being a regular person to being someone that gets to make movies?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask about this because I have no experience in the movie industry myself. One way, of course, is to go to film school. It was kind of a cliche that the generation of auteurs in the 70s were called the film school brats. Spike Lee, George Lucas, these people were the first generation of directors to have graduate degrees in filmmaking. But that's not the only way. There are people who get to make movies because they get other kinds of jobs in the industry and then find themselves behind the camera, but that involves a significant amount of luck. And of course, you may have noticed that many of the people who end up behind the camera start out in front of it. Actors who are popular, stars, have, of course, a better chance of making their own movies than the average person does. There are lots of jobs, of course, in filmmaking. It requires 100 people, hundreds of people to make a movie. That's a lot of jobs. A lot of students from Carnegie Mellon go out to California and take jobs at the lower levels of the industry, and some of them have the success of working their way up. I only know of one of our students who has actually directed a commercial Hollywood movie. There might be others I don't know about. And he did go to film school. The industry has lots of positions. It's not so hard to get into the industry. It is much more difficult to actually get behind the camera and make your own commercial film. Now, if you just want to make a movie, that's easy these days. In fact, the cost of the equipment is so much lower today than it has ever been, partly because digital filmmaking is now the norm rather than the exception, and digital cameras are relatively easy to obtain. That's something that anybody can do, and that's, of course, one way that you can perhaps break into the industry. You make movies, you try to get people to look at them, and if they like what they see, they might get you a job. But the problem there is that because it's now so inexpensive to make movies, so many people are doing it. And so it's now, people now guess that literally 10,000 movies, feature-length movies, are made every year, most of which are seen by no more than a few dozen people, because they don't have any, there's no good way to distribute them. Mm-hmm. You can put them on YouTube, but how do you get people to watch them?
Yeah. On the topic of production budget, you see Hollywood movies with hundreds of millions of dollars in production budget and CGI everywhere. What motivates the Hollywood studios to spend that much money on CGI that didn't exist for all the good movies of the past?
Well, I think they believe it's what people want. And by that, I don't necessarily mean the majority of the population wants that, but the majority of people who go to movies with some regularity in theaters, that audience, Hollywood believes, wants to see grandiose special effects. It wants to see things people can't see in other ways, basically. I mean, you can't really see the power of these effects on a small screen. And people who like these movies know that, so they will pay to go to the theater to see them. And of course, Hollywood has, since the 1970s, been built around the idea of the blockbuster, which means, actually, it even goes back further than the 70s, but in the 50s, even, studios began to make most of their money from a few films that had the biggest box office. Prior to that, Hollywood made most of its money from having lots of films in theaters and making small profits on most of them. So that change begins in the 50s. And then in the 70s, it intensifies. And Hollywood makes a few movies, like The Godfather is usually pointed to as the first example, where a single film makes so much money that it now becomes worth it to try to figure out how can we make that movie, because that will keep us in business. But of course, the risk is that you can put all this money into such a film and it becomes a complete flop. There are, of course, famous examples like Heaven's Gate, where there's an enormous budget and literally no one goes to see the movie. So, and more commonly, films don't completely bomb in that way, but they don't make their production budget back. every time a movie is released, there's a risk involved. And in fact, the movie, the system is now riskier for any given film because the odds of any particular film hitting are probably lower than they've ever been.
In terms of the movie industry, I've watched a few Bollywood movies. I'm Indian, and so a lot of times the most popular music in India at any given time is a song from a Bollywood movie. In contrast, in the United States, it seems like the two industries, film and music, are relatively more separate. You might get the occasional rapper starring in a movie, but the popular music isn't featured in films. Has that always been the case?
No. There was a time when movies had a great impact on the popularity of music in the 30s and 40s. There was a lot of crossover between the two industries. Bing Crosby, for example, started out as a radio star and went on to be one of Paramount's leading box office actors. The song White Christmas was first used in a Hollywood movie called Holiday Inn. It became so popular that it was the occasion for its own movie, White Christmas, with Bing Crosby as the star. So, there was a lot of crossover between the movies and music, and that lasts into the 60s. Elvis Presley was the leading male box office star in the early 1960s, and that was not because people thought he was a great actor.
Yeah. What do you think drove that trend of the two industries separating, or do you think it just happened naturally with people's preferences for music?
I think it has something to do with the changing character of movies, that music is not as important in the movies as it used to be. But also the way music is used is different. So prior to the late 60s, most movies had orchestral scores. If they used popular music, which musical films always did, but which dramatic films did relatively less often, that popular music was diegetic. It was performed in the context of the film's narrative. With The Graduate in 1967, you get the first instance of what is essentially a compiled score. The director took Simon and Garfunkel records that had all previously been released and used them as background music for much of the film. That helped Simon and Garfunkel. I mean, people bought their records because they heard it in the movie. But of course, it didn't introduce new music except for the one song that Simon and Garfunkel wrote, or Paul Simon wrote for the movie, Mrs. Robinson. It didn't introduce new music into the world. And the compiled score then becomes, not right away, but after a few years, increasingly common in Hollywood. But the compiled score almost always consists of older music. The movies are trading on music that people are familiar with, which helps to sell the movie. People want to come and hear the music they like, but it doesn't help sell new music.
So the trend kind of flipped in terms of which one was coming first. That makes sense. I think we're coming up near the end of our time today. It's been great having you on the show. To sign us off, tell us one movie that you think not enough people have seen that our audience should take a look at. Doesn't have to be recent.
Well, I will mention the film that I usually say when people ask me what my favorite movie is. It's The Big Sleep, directed by Howard Hawks, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. It's based on a hard-boiled detective novel by Raymond Chandler. It is a film noir, though it is a unusual film noir because it has a more or less happy ending, and it involves a love story. It was a film that was made to showcase on screen the off-screen relationship between Bogart and Bacall. They got married just before the film was released. They had met on the set of To Have and Have Not, which was the film that each of them starred in just before this one. So it's a really interesting combination of a crime story and a love story. It has great dialogue, has some wonderful scenes, and if you know anything about Howard Hawks films, you can tell who the devil made it.
Well, you heard it here, people. The Big Sleep. That should be the next movie on your watch list. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3. We just interviewed Professor David Shumway, professor of film in the literature department at Carnegie Mellon University. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Lenore with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. While coronavirus infections could go down over the next few months, we're still headed into flu season. Millions of Americans will be affected by the flu. But the good news is that we do have a safe and effective vaccine. But sadly, too many people go unvaccinated, especially African Americans. For more about flu vaccine, talk to your doctor or visit aawellnessproject.org.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine, hailing from Texas. We have Gavin, here with us today. Welcome to The Angry Young Man.
Hello.
Yeah. So, I had a couple things that would be interesting for us to talk about. I know there was something you wanted to talk about, but I've been reading what some may call the book of the year so far. I'm reading Abundance by Ezra Klein.
I have a copy of that.
You have a copy of that? I just now got a copy because they had quite ironically, Abundance was not abundant for a period of time, I just got a copy of it. It's interesting because, you know, if for those of you who have listened to the show before, you'll know that I have a little bit of a fixation with housing, but it's interesting to see, you know, this argument for abundance liberalism and talking about using state capacity to kind of pursue growth and look at these things. I've only gotten about 30 pages into it so far. There's some things that I agree with. There's some things I disagree with. But I guess we'll start off this segment by kind of getting at that. I mean, Gavin, would you consider yourself an abundance liberal?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I agree with the idea. I don't know.
I mean,
how would you define abundance liberal? And we'll go from there.
Well, I find it kind of the defining factor that separates it, the abundance liberal from, say, you know, the free market absolutist or fundamentalist, is the idea that there's a necessity to use state capacity to go after both supply and demand. They look at it as, and they open in the book by saying that, you know, for so long, because the fundamental kind of crux of economics is supply and demand, how it's been divided in half, and each side of the political spectrum has kind of made one of those their baby, in the sense that the right has been entirely supply focused and the left has been entirely demand focused. And, you know, the lack of understanding that both have their own importance, because they are supply and demand, not just supply or just demand. They kind of advocate for the, you know, the pushing of both to mm-hmm. go about things. I mean, I have my fair share of disagreements kind of going out the gate with some of the claims, specifically as they relate to using state capacity to push for a lot of these things or to subsidize demand. Or to look for some of those things. They may be addressed later in the book. I haven't gotten just far into it just yet. But I'm curious. To what degree do you subscribe to those sorts of claims? And if so, what's your critique of say the market fundamentalist approach that I'm sure you know you're aware that I hold on this matter.
I'd say. In all things, in housing, which is our first topic, in food, in water, there we have, I guess, the title of the book, we already have a superabundance of all of these things. We have enough where if we had the perfect allocation of resources, a perfect system, nobody would ever starve. Because we have more food than anyone could eat. We have more housing. We have more homes than homeless people. All of these things. So we're at a point now where it's not really a matter of how do we grow food? How do we have more houses? How do we have enough for everyone to survive? Which is what most of human history was about. And we now are at a point of, okay, how do we think about our systems to have them structured in such a way that everyone has enough. And I think that's kind of where we should be going forward as a society at this point. So especially in terms of housing, I don't think we should accept homeless people as a concept at all. And if that means somebody has like a homeless shelter, that's like a little studio apartment, then that's what that is. I think you should be given the bare minimum. And I think beyond that, if you want to work for something harder, absolutely. Like even, and this is where I'm going to lose people, but like even if you're like a drug addict and you want to be in your home all day doing drugs, I don't think you should have a particularly good quality of life. I don't think, because you're not contributing to society at all. But I don't think it's very ethical to say somebody should die in that circumstance, just should be on the street and have no societal support. And it's not even like an ethical thing. Like homeless people are a drain on society as they exist. If they overdose, that's a drain on our medical system. If they live in like a northern climate, Pittsburgh, whatever, and it's the winter and they have pneumonia or frostbite or whatever. I don't know. I'm from Texas, so I don't know what happens when you get cold. It's a mystery. That's also a drain on the medical system. If they do a crime because they're so desperate and hungry and they have to go to prison, that's a drain on our prison system. So I think overall, you can even make an argument that just housing these people would be a cost-saving measure for society, for taxpayers overall. So that's sort of my position.
So, I mean, one of the kind of key things I want to zone in on, no pun intended, is... you know, you mentioned, you know, the crisis of homelessness, and something that they bring up very quickly in the section on at the outset is this idea of, you know, why do we have homelessness? Why does this happen? And you know, they kind of zone in on the fact that more often than not, it's a cost issue, you know, in terms of how much the homes cost. And you know, in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily agree that we have enough housing or an abundance of housing. You know, at least in our metropolitan areas, there's not an abundance in the sense that we're able to address the massive demand of these areas. You look at states like California and New York that have been historically and notoriously bad at trying to address these issues with their zoning policies. I mean, you can drag in redlining if you really wanted to, but you know, it kind of falls down on this issue of there's this strand of liberal policy which has attempted to restrict supply, and as a result, has caused the crisis of homelessness, because all of these other things that we look at as a result, where you have the drug epidemic as a result, or turning to violence, these are symptoms of the problem, not necessarily the problem in of themselves. So, I mean, at least coming from my part of things, you know, you can address the cost issue at no cost by pulling back on a lot of these regulations that states like California and New York have been putting so much effort into holding up, and or at least have felt the pressure from the NIMBYs in their respective communities to uphold these regulations, which, quite frankly, it doesn't really cost anything materially outside of maybe the administrative cost of just kind of keeping the lights on while you're debating it. You know, for you to roll back these things, and you already experience so much change from there that, you know, it's an ambiguous amount of change. You know, how much are you going to make a dent in the homeless population? How much are housing prices going to fall down? But you could look at some pretty good case examples. You know, in your home state of Texas, I believe it was Austin that just recently saw rents tumble about 20% because the housing stock went up. You know, and that's it ultimately falls down to, you know, can you allow the market to address demand? I mean, if you're getting rid of these artificial caps, that should do enough in of itself. And then you kind of ask the question, well, is it necessary for us to start subsidizing demand again. On your front of things, it would appear that your position, to an extent, requires some amount of subsidizing demand or, doing some sort of subsidy to allow for access to housing. So I'm curious if that, how that would play out and to what degree the government or state capacity to act would be necessary if you were able to pull back on just the caps on supply.
Yeah, so just to re-clarify my position, like obviously right now, there is a lot of cities where the housing situation is so far not great, not conducive to like universal housing. How do I put this? Like you were saying, like rents are exorbitantly high in Los Angeles and New York. But I think my position is this is not like a human economic. Like we have the labor capacity, we have the technology to build enough homes for everyone to live. Just simply, just as simple as that. So then the question becomes, why don't we have that? I think you adequately addressed some of these issues. All of it is just policy issues, basically. Some of it might be like cultural or whatever, but I feel like the vast majority is policy. These are policy decisions that are very deliberately put in place. A lot of it is like the YIMBY NIMBY debate. I was going to bring up Austin myself because it's an example I'm well aware of. It's right in my neighborhood, so to speak. Austin has grown so much. You can look at a skyline picture of like Austin in 2015 versus Austin today, and it's like it looks like a different city. And this isn't like because nobody wants rents are also super low in Austin. And there's like two sides of that. There's supply and demand. And one might be tempted to say, well, nobody wants to live in Austin, but that's just not the case. You ask anybody.
Do you want to live in Austin?
I'd like to. Like everyone wants to live in Austin. Austin's the cool place to live. It's like the LA of Texas. Like people want to go there. So it's clearly not like a low demand thing. It's they're doing something right. I think they've enacted good policies. Houston has done similar things. They have very, very notoriously soft zoning policies. So there's that, obviously. I think you would have to have a very strong state capacity if you wanted to like provide a universal layer of guaranteed homelessness. But I think it is possible. I think a really good example of this is Japan. Japan is a country of almost a billion people, right?
A good amount.
I don't know.
Off the top of my head, but yeah,
maybe like, okay, 100 million. Okay, not nearly as much as I thought, but...
a lot of people. We'll put it that way.
They have, in their entire country, about 2,000 homeless people. And this is like in Tokyo. Like if there was a city the size of Tokyo in the US, there would be like a bajillion homeless people. So clearly like Japan is doing something right. And I think a big thing is that they have a pretty generous welfare system there. That kind of just doesn't accept homelessness is this thing. And I think a lot of it in Japan is also a cultural thing. Like this culture of there's a very, very strong stigma around homelessness and also like around hospitality. But I think a lot of it is like statewide decisions on the part of a government to support like very strong housing policies, because Tokyo is another place that has notoriously very low rents for a city of its size.
Well, I think you can look
at Tokyo also has very, very you know, not great houses, but like these tiny, tiny little condos that people have.
Yeah, that's kind of...
that's fine. That's great. That beats living on the street.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of things that I would want. I would want like not a great quality of housing. Because obviously like cost is a worry, but like anything's better than people living on the streets.
Yeah.
So if there's a way to do this with like it being entirely free market, I would like that. But so far I haven't seen a good case of this being done like entirely through market forces and market incentives. So just to go back to your question, yeah, I think you would have to have a pretty strong government program for this to work.
I guess the one thing, and I will kind of pivot from there, is, you know, in the case of Japan, they have extreme, especially Tokyo, extreme density, which allows, you know, is a supply thing. They have enormous supply.
Sure.
I mean, maybe it's not the best supply. You mentioned that, you know, they're not the best apartments, but it's supply nevertheless, which allows, you know, rents to go down like that. But, you know, there's a lot to consider, I guess, very briefly, because I know there's a bigger topic we want to get to. While we're on the topic of other nations, you know, immigration never ceases to be a topic of interest. I know we have very many overlapping positions on this, but I guess the thing I wanted to probe you on a little bit was, as it relates to... the illegal nature of crossings, you know, be it for someone who's, you know, either of ill intent or not, I guess, you know, because we definitely agree, you know, there needs to be reform in the system as it relates to making it easier to immigrate. But as it relates to people who do come illegally, if you do go about treating it as a criminal offense, being that it you know, it is a crossing that is not legal. So I'm curious to probe your thoughts on that, especially being from a border state. Kind of very briefly what you think.
I have to organize my thoughts for a second. Sorry. I feel like when we call it like this illegal, like it moralizes it a lot that they've done some big crime. And I just don't see illegal things as necessarily morally bad things. You know, you can imagine a situation like a mother stealing food for her starving kids. I don't see that as morally bad. And a lot of the times this illegal immigration is a similar thing. It's these people in very, very desperate situations, so desperate that like I can't even imagine having to make some of these decisions. I know in the case of a very famous case recently of I'm not sure exactly what his name is. I think it's Kilmar Abrego Garcia. It's
the Venezuelan gentleman.
El Salvadorian.
We're jumping between El Salvador and Venezuela so much right now in the news. Get the streams crossed. But yes.
He was coming to the United States because a gang back in El Salvador was threatening the life of him and his family. And he came here and he worked in the United States. He has a pretty good paying job. He's contributing to the economy. He's paying taxes. He's buying local goods. He has a family. He has a wife who's an American citizen. He has kids here. And even though, yes, he came here illegally originally, I'm not comfortable saying he's any less American than you and me. And so it's sort of a case by case basis like that. If they're coming here to do terrible things, then obviously I'm not happy with that. If they're here to do crimes, if they're here to smuggle drugs, that's not great. But I don't think that's the vast majority of the people who are being deported right now. So I think you'd have to deal with that on a case by case basis, decide, is this person well integrated in the American society and the American economy? Are they contributing to our economy? And did they come here under a situation of distress? I think those are all considerations you have to make in these cases. And I think more often than not, I would like these people to stay here because it is a good thing for immigrants to be here. And it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah. And I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement that, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
I mean, yeah. Neither of us are Native Americans, I don't think. Imagine. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans, so we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious, to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're still talking about, irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even maybe a moral ambiguity, you know, there is a law that's broken. I think that's, you know, the kind of the key core and principle thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. You know, I would assume this is of a broad sort of kind of heady general, what do we think here? But I'm getting, is there something specifically that you wanted to touch on?
So this is for a class project of mine, obviously. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. So there's this sort of model of three different models of marriage. So there's this idea of a traditional marriage. This is what you imagine, like the housewife. You know, the wife typically doesn't work. If she does, it's like maybe a part-time job. She does the majority of the housework, the majority of taking care of kids. And then there is this neo-traditional model. Let's hold that thought. Let's go to the opposite end. There's this progressive model where this is what, like, a very egalitarian person would advocate all marriage should look like. You know, equal, both the mother and the father are breadwinners. You know, they might have roughly equal incomes, and they split housework, they split caring for the kids equally amongst them. And then there's this neo-traditional model, which is a bit of a mix of the two. Of this, basically the mother does work, but she also does the brunt of the housework, of the taking care of the kids. And I wonder, of those three models of marriage, which of those would sound the most appealing to you? Which of those you believe, not our society should be structured on, but which do you believe you would want your ideal marriage to look like?
Oh, this is interesting. We're breaking from the politics here on the show, which is cool, I guess.
Let's say scaling it down to a microscopic level.
I guess we can say that. I mean, listen, I'm in many ways, I'm an old school guy. You know, that's just the kind of world I grew up in. More often than not, the type of people of my background gravitate towards the neo-traditional in a lot of ways. Because I think this is also informed in a lot of ways by my faith. I definitely think, you know, as a Catholic, you know, there's this, in conception of marriage, we define, you know, separate but equally important roles for both the man and the woman in the relationship. And I think, you know, this is kind of the thing that's lost on a lot of people when they look at the Catholic or, you know, even generally Christian conceptions of of marriage between a man and a woman, because it's, you know, obviously there are certain things that both the man and the woman have going on for their respective roles in the marriage, but they are of equal importance, and there's equal accountability between both halves to hold up their end of the bargain. I don't think that the neo-traditional model really deviates much from that, from the traditional, in so much as it still maintains kind of the core essence of what's going on, with some, you know, realities that kind of reflect back on potentially some of the socioeconomic factors we have to kind of put into consideration for a lot of families that are currently trying to make ends meet and need to live on two incomes. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely not easy in New York to afford to live there when the median households...
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Lenore with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. While coronavirus infections could go down over the next few months, we're still headed into flu season. Millions of Americans will be affected by the flu. But the good news is that we do have a safe and effective vaccine. But sadly, too many people go unvaccinated, especially African Americans.